Greetings, everyone around the world in 50 countries. Laszlo Montgomery here, once again with another China History Podcast episode. We're going to explore the Shang Dynasty today. If the Xia Dynasty, which we discussed in the last podcast, was a legendary dynasty, then we could call the Shang a semi-legendary dynasty. The Xia and Shang have a lot in common. They both have legendary beginnings that start with a virtuous and great leader who is beloved by the people. Then you have the succession, and then a lot of blank spots. Then in the end, you had a wicked tyrant who was hated by the people and ultimately overthrown. The Xia had Emperor Jie. The Shang had Di Xin, who went down in history as Zhou Xin. I'm jumping way ahead, but just trying to show you how both dynasties had similar rises and falls. Unlike the Xia, which made a slow and steady march downhill, the Shang had a great revival, two-thirds of the way into the dynastic period. And it's really the last couple centuries of the Shang that's particularly interesting. The Shang definitely has a lot more to hang on to than the Xia. Even to this day, the great historiographers, archaeologists, and scientists China has to offer are still analyzing the treasure trove of Shang artifacts that continue to be unearthed even to this day. Already, 11 palaces have been discovered in and around Anyang in Henan province. Believe it or not, it was only in the 20th century that we learned this dynasty actually existed. Sima Qian writes all about the Shang in his Shi Ji, or Records of the Grand Historian. So it's not like we never heard of the Shang before. In his great work, Sima Qian enumerated all the Shang kings. More about this later. I don't want to jump too far ahead. I'm just trying to whet your appetite a little. Like the preceding Xia dynasty, the start and finish dates of the Shang are open to debate. In 1996, the China government launched the Xia Shang Zhou Duan Dai Gongcheng, or a chronology report on the Xia Shang Zhou, to set down a more accurate timestamping for these first three Bronze Age dynasties. In November 2000, the results were announced, and they pegged the Xia at 2070 BC to 1600 BC, and the Shang was split up from 1600 to 1300 BC for the early Shang, and 1300 to 1046 BC for the late Shang. The Zhou, which we will discuss next in another podcast, ran from 1046 to 771 BC. The Shang ran during the middle of China's Bronze Age. In other faraway lands at this time, Egypt is already a mighty empire. It was the period of the great 18th dynasty, the most famous in ancient Egyptian history. It was the time of many of the most famous pharaohs, like Tutankhamun, the Thutmoses, Hatshepsut, Akhenaten, and Nefertiti. The new kingdom in Egypt was just starting. The Shang period in China was also concurrent with the time when Moses of the Old Testament fame was born in Egypt in 1612 BC. This means it was also the time of Ramses I and II. This was just as the Xia was dying out and the Shang was starting to rise. Elsewhere in the world, the temple at Delphi was built in Greece. Mycenaean and Minoan culture was going on. 1149 BC would have been the time of the Trojan War. So, as Chinese civilization was just starting to take shape and organize and consolidate, all these other civilizations were thriving and developing on separate continents, all independent of each other. Even in China, there were more civilizations going on than simply the Shang. But it was only the Shang Dynasty civilization that left behind written records of their existence. In 1987, there was an exciting archaeological discovery in Sichuan near Chengdu. The place was called Sanxingdui, or Three Stars Mound. Lots of artifacts left behind, like beautiful jades and bronzes, attesting to a rather advanced people. But one thing they didn't leave behind was any written record of their time. Unlike the Shang peoples developing up around Henan, Hubei, Shandong, and northern Anhui, this civilization down in the Chengdu region had not yet developed writing. So let's go with 1600 BC as the start of the dynasty. Like the Xia dynasty founder, Yu the Great, the Shang also had another heroic founder. He came to be known as Cheng Tang. He was named Zilu. His ancestor Qi had helped Yu the Great tame the Yellow River floods way back when, and his family was given the land of Shang as a reward. Now, the time of Cheng Teng was already 14 generations later, and by this time, the Shang was already a rather powerful state in its own right. As I mentioned in the last podcast, Cheng Teng defeated the wicked and evil Emperor Jie at the Battle of Mingtiao. Cheng Teng founded the dynasty, and drought strikes immediately. After about 7 years of suffering this drought, King Teng went before heaven and prostrated himself on the altar, presumably at some high temple, and reproached himself before heaven and offered to present himself as a sacrifice to Shang Di if he would only bring rain to the drought-stricken land. Well, as the legend goes, it started to rain soon thereafter, and the farmers rejoiced in Cheng Teng's reputation and esteem as a ruler and a hero skyrocketed. So, Yu the Great, who founded the Xia dynasty, he tamed the floods. Cheng Teng, who founded the Shang, he was able to get the heavens to rain down upon the land. Water is life. The capital of the new Shang government was in Zhengzhou, near the present-day capital of Henan province. The capital of the Shang dynasty moved around a lot. If you form a triangle between the three cities of Zhengzhou, Anyang, and Luoyang, that covers the areas where most of the Shang palaces and major cities have been excavated. It was after the seventh and final move of the capital to a place called Yin where the Shang dynasty reached its apex. At the capital of Yin, 12 kings ruled over 255 years until the Shang period came to an end and the Zhou took over. As I said, the Shang worshipped the god Shang Di. In Mandarin, the word for god is Shang Di. Shang means above, Di means emperor. So this deity was above the emperor, and the emperor, through his special relationship with all the ancestors, held particular closeness with Shang Di. However, Shang Di, the Shang supreme deity, was the main god among several. The Shang religion was not monotheistic by any stretch of the imagination. They were very big on sacrificing animals, and they were strong followers of ancestral worship and revered their ancestors. The Shang people believed in an afterlife and took tomb building and burial in general very seriously. Before we go through various vignettes through this dynastic period, let's zero in on the four contributions to Chinese civilization that we can say came from the Shang period. These are the aspects of the Shang that really define the dynasty and what we most remember them for. First and foremost, writing is seen for the first time in Chinese history. More about this later. The second was the social organization of the country into a very stratified system where everyone had a place and the aristocrats and royal family stood at the apex of Shang society. All these nobles were beholden to the king, and they controlled the outlying areas too far from the capital and the king's everyday control. The priests had a dual role in Shang society. Not only were they entrusted with the job of performing all rituals and religious matters, they were also the bureaucrats of the kingdom and handled all the day-to-day affairs of the government. The third aspect that we can say defines the Shang is their mastery of bronze casting and their bronze-making technological standard. A lot survives to this day, and it's beautiful. The fourth and last thing special about the Shang were their use of bronze and their effective weaponry. This included everything from spears to chariots. In those days, bronze meant power, wealth, luxury. It was only for those who lived at the imperial court or the aristocrats who had bronze in their daily life. Bronze wasn't anything that the peasants possessed or came in contact with. All these bronze objects were basically either one of two things. Bronze was used to make weapons or ceremonial vessels, never for common tools. Now, I'm sure everyone knows this, but just in case, bronze is a metal alloy made up mostly of copper with tin. You can't imagine how much of this stuff has been dug up over the last century. In the final years of the Shang, especially during the Yin Shang period, important events and records were inscribed or cast in bronze ceremonial objects. The Shang people, because of their superior bronze-making technology, were able to make more effective weapons, like spears, compound bows, and better horse-drawn chariots. This made them the conquerors to beat of their time. Sima Qian wrote in the Shiji that there were a total of 30 Shang rulers, covering roughly 600 years. Court officials belonged to a hereditary class of aristocrats. The core of the dynasty was located in the northern part of Henan. The crops of those days were millet, wheat, and barley. Remember, the rice-growing region of China is in the south. These ancient dynasties were all developing in the north. In China, even still today, wheat is eaten in the north, it's rice in the south. I mean, everybody eats everything, but as a general rule, you'll see more people eating breads and noodles in the north than in the south. The Shang used the lunar calendar, or Yueli, to date all the events of their time. Believe it or not, this same lunar calendar was used in China all the way up to the last century. They also developed a 12-month calendar with 365 and a quarter days. All around the world, the great civilizations developing pretty much all figured that one out. Can you imagine, though, being the first person 4, 5, maybe 6,000 years ago actually keeping track day to day over a period of 365 days, 4 years, and being the first to understand the concept of a single year and a leap year? In addition to this, the Shang also developed the decimal system and had already begun to develop sophistication with math and science. Well, let's get right into the whole bangers and mash here as far as the Shang is concerned. If you could say anything about the ancient Chinese who developed during the Shang period, these were the people who gave us Chinese characters. The legend has it that Hanzi, or Zhongwenzi, a.k.a. Chinese characters, were invented during the time of the Yellow Emperor, around 2650 BC, by one of his officials, Cang Jie. Cang Jie had four eyes. He's the legendary creator of Chinese writing. Cang Jie didn't leave any evidence of his existence. The Chinese of the Shang Dynasty, they did. But the story behind writing really begins in the last year of the 19th century. In 1899, in and around the city of Anyang in Henan Province, all these so-called Longgu started showing up. Long means dragon, gu means bone. These dragon bones were being dug up all over Anyang and the environs around the Huan River. Some ended up in the hands of private Chinese antique collectors who were fascinated with the archaic-looking characters carved into the bone. Some of the bones ended up with practitioners of Chinese medicine who ground these bones up into powders used to cure a variety of ailments. Among these ailments was malaria. And so it was in 1899 that the director of the Imperial College, Dr. Wang Yirong, seeking relief from malaria, was given some of these dragon bones to grind up and consume. Now, Dr. Wang's trained eye noticed all these inscriptions on these dragon bones. Now, up until this moment in our recent history, the Shang Dynasty was about as legendary as the Xia. There were a lot of stories and legends, and of course, we had Sima Qian's account of that period. A lot of smoke, but no fire. Well, Dr. Wang Yirong was able to trace these dragon bones to a village called Xiaotun, outside the city of Anyang. By 1917, Mr. Wang Guowei had deciphered the bone inscriptions of the names of the Shang kings. And if only Sima Qian had lived to see this day, because when the inscriptions were figured out and they placed the results side by side with what Sima Qian had written in his Shiji 19 centuries earlier, they matched perfectly. So Sima Qian wasn't blowing any smoke. Well, once these discoveries were made and the archaeologists figured roughly where the Shang Kingdom was situated, they started pulling treasures out of the ground like you can't believe. Tomb after tomb, bronze masterpiece after bronze masterpiece, and hundreds of thousands of shells and bones, all inscribed with ancient Chinese characters. And it was through decades of studying that the whole story of the Shang and of Shang society slowly revealed itself. From this time onward, the Shang was no longer a legendary dynasty. From 1928 until the Japanese invaded China in 1937, they started excavating Yinshu. This is where they discovered the royal palace, royal tombs, and a veritable treasure trove of these dragon bones that were soon thereafter called oracle bones. This script is called the Jiagu Wen. Oracle bones made predictions about the future. For the most part, these were the scapulas or shoulder blades of water buffalo or some kind of cattle. The second most prevalent method was using the shells of tortoises. Using these early characters, questions were carved into the bones of the shells. On the opposite side, a number of small pits were carved, and into these little crevices or pits that they carved, they inserted these thin, hot metal rods. This would in turn cause the bones or shells to crack. And then the priests would interpret or divine these cracks, and thus the question was answered. Then the answer to the question was carved into the same bone or the shell, and taking it one step further, the actual outcome would also be carved by one scribe or another. And it was through studying these artifacts, and there were a couple hundred thousand to study, that the scientific community there had been able to piece together the story of the Shang. One after another, names of kings were confirmed, style of government was revealed, battles, military history, as well as religious beliefs slowly were discovered. In time, a fairly good understanding of Shang society was learned, and it was also from these bones that it was learned that the Shang were constantly at war with outsiders from near and far. You see, 8 or 9 generations after Cheng Tang founded the dynasty, the Shang had deteriorated into a never-ending battle between brothers and other relatives, always fighting for power at the top. Resources were wasted building palaces and pleasure domes where nobles lived in splendor and luxury. It was only when Pan Geng comes to the throne that the Shang revives and then reaches its climax under Wu Ding. Pan Geng, who ruled from 1290 to 1263 BC, was the ruler who ripped the whole capital up by its roots and moved it to Yin. It wasn't a terribly popular move, and no one, common people included, wanted to leave their comfortable surroundings and start all over somewhere else. Nonetheless, that's what ended up happening, and Pan Geng is credited as the founder of the Yin Dynasty, or Yin Shang period, and for reviving the sinking ship that the Shang had become. Now, I mentioned Yin Xu a little bit ago. The last part of the Shang Dynasty, as I mentioned, was where the dynasty reached its height of power and sophistication. The capital was located in the city of Yin in northern Henan, close to the borders of Shanxi and Hebei. Xu means ruins, so Yin Xu simply means the ruins of Yin. From this point on, the dynasty is called the Yin Shang, or sometimes just the Yin Dynasty. From Yin, 12 kings ruled for another 255 years. All of these artifacts being pulled from the ground came from the Yin period. We're somewhere near the beginning of the 14th century BC now. The Shang is in its golden age. One of the best preserved sites at Yinshu is the tomb of Fu Hao, or Lady Hao. Lady Hao was the wife of King Wu Ding, where the Yin Shang reached its greatest heights. Lady Hao was not only wife of the king, she was a great military leader in her own right and led successful campaigns against some of the Shang's enemies. Her tomb was discovered in the tumultuous year in China of 1976. 1976 will always go down in China as a banner year. First of all, Premier Zhou Enlai died. Then Zhu De, one of the great military heroes and founding fathers. Zhu's death was followed in the same month by the massive 23-second, 7.8 on the Richter scale, Tangshan earthquake that killed over 250,000 inhabitants. Then Chairman Mao died, and the whole power grab then ensued. Amidst all this, in the winter of 1976, the Fu Hao Mu was discovered. Mu means tomb in this case. So, the Fu Hao tomb was discovered. Now, like King Tut in Egypt, Fu Hao's tomb had been discovered undisturbed. So, for almost 28 centuries, the tomb's hidden location had eluded grave robbers. It was opened to the public as an exhibit in 1999 at the Yinshu Museum in Anyang. It's definitely on my list of places to go. The Great Bronze Age Queen Fu Hao's tomb had been dated to about 1200 BC, and it was positively identified as Fu Hao's tomb by all the bronze inscriptions, or Jinwen, as all these bronze inscriptions were called. Buried with this great queen and military leader were all kinds of jade and carved bone objects, things like arrowheads, hairpins, and other ornamental objects. There was a massive cache of bronze artifacts like weapons, bells, knives, mirrors, statues of animals, real and mythical. They also uncovered stone objects, art made from ivory, and even 6,900 pieces of the coin of the realm at the time, cowrie shells. found in the burial chamber of Queen Fuhao were the skeletal remains of 6 dogs and 16 humans, presumably slaves. It was already known at the time, however, that the Shang period saw a degree of human sacrifices. The oracle bones uncovered at the site revealed that Fuhao was the greatest military leader of her time. As I said, she was the wife of the 21st Shang Emperor Wu Ding. He led the Yin Shang dynasty at its peak. And as I said, the Yin period of the Shang was the high point of the entire Shang dynasty. Before we finish up the Shang and the evil and wicked last emperor, let's look at Shang writing. Chinese characters first appear during this dynasty in both oracle bones and in these bronze ritual vessels. If anything was committed to paper or some other organic substrate, they've long disappeared. There's been anywhere from 3,000 to 5,000 characters that have been cataloged from all the findings by archaeologists. Having this ability to communicate and record information in writing gave the Shang rulers a very enhanced ability to rule. It really allowed the central authority to spread his wings out a little wider and directly control farther areas of the kingdom. Anyways, the amazing thing about this early Shang writing is that written Chinese today basically uses the same system they came up with over 2,000 years ago. The system of writing that uses a radical to give the character a general meaning or classification, joined together with a phonetic symbol of some sort to indicate a sound, is still used today. And the amazing thing about Chinese characters, ancient and modern, is that they're similar to Arabic numerals in that no matter how you pronounce them, the meaning is always the same. So Chinese writing first starts appearing between 1500 to 1200 BC. Writing was already in use for about 1,000 years in the Indus River Valley civilization, and for almost 1,000 years before that by the Egyptians. It was the Mesopotamian civilizations that were the earliest. Writing appeared in ancient Sumer as early as 3200 BC, a good 2,000 years before the Shang oracle bones. As I mentioned, the Shang wasn't the only civilization thriving in China proper. I mentioned San Xing Dui in Sichuan as a good example. But only the Shang left this cornucopia of written records of their existence and of their very structured and strictly layered society. Well, all good things have to come to an end, and indeed, it came to a smashing and violent conclusion for the Shang. Like the Xia before them, this dynasty also suffered from a tyrant who was remembered in infamy. The Xia had Emperor Jie. The Shang, they had Emperor Zhou, born Di Xin. Other than being credited as the creator of chopsticks, this Emperor Zhou Xin went down in history as the worst king of all time. It's said that his name, Zhou, that's fourth tone, was a pejorative name given to him to show disrespect. The Zhou was part of a saddle that was near the horse's rump or underside, and its main role was to keep the saddle from sliding forward. Anyways, its strategic location right under or near the horse's poop chute made it the likeliest part of the saddle to become soiled. So you can imagine how much they liked this guy if they gave him a name like that. But like Caligula, who was to follow him almost 100 centuries later, Di Xin started off good. He supposedly had this amazing strength and was just a mountain of a man capable of all kinds of amazing feats. It seemed behind every tyrannical ruler, there was always some evil woman behind the scenes egging him on to do the most outrageous things. And this last Shang emperor was no exception. In his case, it was the evil Daji, whose greatest pleasure was to watch the painful suffering of others. Now, Di Xin, or Zhou Xin, either way, he did a lot of outrageous things on his own and at the behest of his sadistic wife. There was a book written during the Ming Dynasty, one of the later dynasties in China, that chronicles the period of the fall of the Shang. The book goes into all kinds of detail about Zhou Xin's exploits. It's called the Feng Shen Yan Yi, the creation of the gods. Let's see, he had this large pit dug where he had all these poisonous snakes all writhing together at the bottom, and this is where he would cast any concubines that failed to humor him or got him angry. He also did the Xia King Jie thing and constructed a lake filled with alcohol. Yep, King Zhou made this called a Jiu Chi Rou Lin, which translates to alcohol pool and meat forest. Yeah, in the middle of this man-made lake, they created an island where they had these trees with branches that were made from shish kebab skewers from which meats were hung for those participating in the orgy or whatever it was that was going on. But the topper of all toppers, the one that every source I read mentioned, was the Pao Luo Zhi Xing, or the cannon-burning punishment. Now, this grisly punishment was attributed to the wicked Queen Daji, and you had this long bronze cylinder, like a cannon, and it was placed into a pit of white-hot burning charcoal, and through the magic of physics and thermodynamics, the cannon itself would turn equally hot. Now, whoever it was that was being punished or was being utilized as the source of amusement was made to walk barefoot on this cannon, which of course was burning hot. And to really make it particularly amusing to the queen, the cannon would be coated with a slippery oil, which made it even more impossible to stand on. And you know, ultimately, everyone ended up falling into the charcoal pit, where they were consumed quickly and painfully. So all these antics, coupled with his ruthless and autocratic ways, simply turned his own people against him. The mandate of heaven was not with him, and it came to pass in early 1045 BC that King Wu of Zhou put an end to Emperor Zhou. Notice that's Emperor Zhou, fourth tone, who was defeated by King Wu of Zhou. That's Zhou, first tone. That's the Zhou state. Two different characters, two different tones. And at the Battle of Muye, the last Shang emperor went down in defeat, and it's from this date that we have the start of the Zhou dynasty, the last of China's Bronze Age dynasties. Now, before the evil Emperor Zhou went down for the count, revolts against the excesses of the king had broken out all over the Shang Empire. Now, the head of the Zhou kingdom was Ji Chang, better known as King Wen of Zhou. Zhou Wenwang, he had made the right alliances and had made the Zhou kingdom the strongest contender among all these various smaller kingdoms. His son was named Ji Fa, or better known as King Wu. Zhou Wuwang, who I just spoke about, who ultimately brought the Shang dynasty down. One last little tidbit for you regarding Ji Chang. Word had been passed through various sources to the evil Emperor Zhou Xin about Ji Chang and how he was so widely respected by the people and how various tribes loyal to the Shang were now doing an about-face and declaring loyalty to Ji Chang. Zhou Xin summons him to the capital at Yin, or present-day Anyang, and Ji Chang dutifully goes to Zhou Xin, who immediately throws him in prison, where, as the story goes, Ji Chang wrote the I Ching, or the Book of Changes, that Confucius called the most important of all the classics. It was the ultimate guide for divination. Ji Chang, after 7 years of imprisonment by Zhou Xin, was ultimately set free after the emperor was given a multitude of bribes and gifts and lots of gorgeous women and all kinds of delights. So Ji Chang is set free and at once begins organizing all the various tribes and peoples, and they pour out of the Wei River Valley from the west and swept into the Shang territory. And this all culminates, as I said, at the Battle of Muye, and Zhou Xin, seeing he was finished, supposedly committed suicide, and his evil queen, Da Ji, she got beheaded. We'll get more into King Wen and Wu and the Duke of Zhou, or Zhou Gong, in the next podcast when we look at the Zhou dynasty. Again, another dynasty famous for its beautiful bronzes. Starting from the Zhou, Chinese culture really begins to get refined, and the stage is being set for the introduction of all the great Chinese philosophers. We've knocked off the Xia and the Shang, and we have the Zhou next. Then we'll sort of combine the warring states and spring and autumn periods into one single podcast, and then maybe we'll stop and do a quick overview of maybe seven of the great Chinese philosophers of the time. Lao Tzu, Confucius, Mo Tzu, Meng Tzu, Shang Yang, Han Fei Zi, and Xun Zi. Then we have the Qin Dynasty and the first emperor of a unified China, Qin Shi Huang Di, who was our featured subject for the first China History podcast. Maybe I'll re-upload that podcast for anyone who has come late to the party and didn't get to download that one. I'm not sure what I did wrong, but iTunes only keeps the 10 most recent shows. So after I upload this one on the Shung, the shows covering Qin Shi Huang, the Four Great Inventions, the Great Leap Forward, and the Intro to Five Generations of Chinese Leadership won't be available, except for my archive on my website at ChinaHistoryPodcast.com. So anything you want to download that you can't get on iTunes, you go to my archive at the website, which again, ChinaHistoryPodcast.com. So I might re-upload that Qin Shi Huang episode to keep the continuity of this dynastic overview. Then it's upwards and onwards to the Han Dynasty as we make our march towards 1911. And so, once again, this is Laszlo Montgomery wishing everybody a fond and appreciative farewell from the city of Claremont, California, home of the illustrious China Project at the Center for Process Studies, located at the prestigious Claremont School of Theology. Join us each week at the China History Podcast for another tasty dim sum from the vast and sumptuous buffet of Chinese history.